Chapter 7. Pitch-black night had descended on the terraces of the finest spot on Earth, Vladimir Hill, whose brick paths and alleyways were hidden under an endless downy mantle of virgin snow. No inhabitant of the city ever sets foot on that huge terraced prominence in the wintertime. And indeed, who would venture onto it at night, especially at such a time? It is simply a horrendous place. It's no place even for the brave. And in any case, there is nothing to do there. There is just one part that is lit. For 100 years now, the dark metallic figure of Saint Vladimir has been standing on his awe-inspiring massive plinth, holding in his outstretched hand an 18-foot-high cross. Every evening, as soon as the snowdrifts, slopes, and terraces become enveloped in twilight, the cross lights up, continuing to shine throughout the night. The light is visible for some 30 miles, as far as the dark, distant plains stretching away in the direction of Moscow. But on the hillside itself, very little is illuminated, just a feeble white light falling onto the dark green plinth and picking out of the darkness the balustrade and a section of the railing bordering the middle terrace. And that is all. Go just a little distance away, and you'll find nothing but total darkness. The snow-capped trees have a strange appearance, like chandeliers wrapped in muslin, and you would sink up to your neck in the snowdrifts. Quite terrifying. So you can understand why no one, even the most daring, should want to go there, mainly because there would be no point. But the city is a different matter. A night of alarm, of military activity, the street lamps shining like strings of beads. The Germans are asleep, but they're sleeping with half-closed eyes. In the darkest alleyway, a blue cone of light suddenly erupts into life.
Halt!
Crunch, crunch, the sound of pawns in their basin-like helmet marching along in the middle of the street, black ear mufflers. Crunch, rifles not on shoulders, but held at the ready. There's no fooling about with Germans, at least not now. Whatever you might think, Germans have to be taken seriously. They're like dung beetles.
Documents! Halt!
A beam of torchlight pierces the dark.
Hey there, you!
A large, black, shiny car with 4 headlights. Clearly no ordinary car, for this gleaming carriage is being escorted by 8 mounted troopers, proceeding at a leisurely trot. But the Germans remain indifferent to this, and shout at the car.
Halt! Your name! Where are you going and why?
General of Cavalry Bielorukov, Commander-in-Chief.
Now that was quite different, of course. Please, General, proceed. A pale moustached face behind the glass, in the depths of the car. The faint glimmer of a general's insignia on his coat. And the German basin-like helmets saluted. Deep down inside, it is true, they actually couldn't care less whether it was General Bielorukov, or Petliura, or some Zulu chief in this lousy country. But still, when in Zululand, do as the Zulus do. So the helmets saluted. Diplomatic courtesies, as the saying goes. A night of military activity. Light streams through the windows of Madame Anjou's boutique, illuminating ladies' hats, corsets, ladies' drawers, and Sevastopol cannon. The cadet on duty marches backwards and forwards like a pendulum, shivering from the cold, tracing the imperial monogram in the snow with his bayonet. And over there, in the Alexandrovsky High School, the assembly hall is lit up like a ballroom. Mishlaevsky, fortified by a sufficient quantity of vodka, is constantly on the move, glancing up at the portrait of Tsar Alexander the Blessed as he makes his way to check the switchbox. The general mood in the school is cheerful, but at the same time, serious. The building is being guarded by 8 machine guns and cadets. No, not students, but cadets. They'll fight all right. Mishlaevsky's eyes are red, like a rabbit's. True, he won't get much sleep tonight, but he's had plenty of vodka, and there's a fair amount of tension to deal with. For the time being, things weren't too difficult in the city. If you're someone with a clear conscience, that's fine. Please go on your way. You'll be stopped about 5 times, of course, but if you have your documents with you, then please, you're free to go. It's surprising you're out at night at all, but please, on your way. But who would climb Vladimir Hill at this time? absolute madness, particularly with the wind howling through the snowdrifts like banshees from hell, as it does in that part of the world. If anyone were to climb the hill, then it could only be some totally desperate outcast who, in any regime on Earth, would feel like a wolf in a pack of dogs. Utterly miserable, like one of Victor Hugo's characters. He would be the sort of person who should not show his face in the city. And if he were to dare show his face, it would be totally at his own risk. Should you manage to evade the patrols, then you've been lucky. But if not, you've only yourself to blame. If such a person were to find his way onto the hill, then he truly deserves our every sympathy. You wouldn't wish it even on a dog. The wind is icy. Just 5 minutes in such a wind, and you'll wish you were safe at home. And yet,
5 hours out here, and my God, we'll freeze to death.
The trouble was that you couldn't reach the upper city by going past the lookout point and the water tower, because Prince Bielorukov's headquarters, you understand, were situated in the monastery building in Mikhailovskaya Street, and you were in constant danger of coming across a military convoy, or armored cars, or...
Officers, damn it! Blast them to hell!
Patrols, patrols, and more patrols. And there was absolutely no point in thinking you might be able to get down to the lower city, to Podol, via the hillside terraces. Firstly, because of the tightly spaced street lamps on Alexandrovskaya Street, winding its way round the foot of Vladimir Hill. And secondly, because of the Germans, damn them. One patrol after another. But what if you tried just before dawn? You'd freeze to death in no time. And as the icy wind whistled along the alleyways, you imagined you could hear the murmur of voices in the snowdrifts by the railing.
We'll freeze to death, Kirpati.
Just be patient, Nemolyaka. The patrols will carry on till daylight, then they'll pack it in and go to bed. We'll slip through to the embankment and stay at Sichika's for a bit of warmth.
Three dark shadows seemed to materialize out of the blackness and started moving along close to the railing, leaning over it to look down onto Alexandrovskaya Street immediately below. The street looked empty and silent, but at any moment two blue-white cones of light might appear, and German armored cars would come speeding along the street, or the sharply defined dark shadows of German troops in their steel helmets. And everything was so close. One of the shadows on Vladimir Hill detached itself from the others.
Hey, Nemolyaka, he hissed through his teeth. Let's risk it and go. We may be able to slip through.
No, things are not right on Vladimir Hill. And believe it or not, things that night weren't going too well at the Hetman's palace either. Something rather unusual and unseemly was happening. An elderly footman with sideboards scurried like a mouse across the gleaming parquet floor of a large room furnished with dowdy gilt chairs. A distant electric bell rang fitfully, accompanied by the jingle of spurs. In one of the bedrooms, the mirrors with tarnished crown-topped frames reflected a strange, unnatural picture. A thin, greying, foxy individual with a clean-shaven face as white as parchment and a clipped moustache was pacing up and down in front of the mirrors. He was wearing an expensive Circassian coat with ornamental silver cartridge cases. Three German and two Russian officers were hovering nearby. One of the Russians was in a Circassian coat, like the foxy man in front of the mirrors, while the other was wearing a military jacket and riding breeches, clearly indicating he was a cavalryman, although he was also sporting Hetmanite wedge-shaped epaulets. They had been helping the foxy man change his clothes. This process had entailed helping him put on his Circassian coat, a pair of broad-bottomed trousers, and patent leather boots. He was now wearing the uniform of a typical German major, and as such, he looked no better and no worse than hundreds of similar German majors. Then the door opened, and the dusty palace curtains parted to admit another man wearing the uniform of a doctor in the German army and carrying a large number of packets. He opened the packets, and with clinically deft movements, bandaged the head of the newly born German major in such a way that all that remained visible was the latter's foxy right eye and thin lips, which were half open to reveal a number of gold and platinum-capped teeth. These unseemly goings-on at the palace continued for a little while. On his way out, the doctor, speaking in German, told the group of officers who were lounging about in the room with the dowdy gilt chairs, as well as in the neighbouring room, that Major von Schratt had accidentally wounded himself in the neck while unloading his revolver, and that he needed to be taken to the German military hospital as a matter of urgency. A telephone rang somewhere, followed by a bird-like tweet from a second telephone. Then a German ambulance with Red Cross markings drove silently through the wrought-iron gates and drew up at the side entrance. Swathed in bandages and wrapped from head to foot in his greatcoat, the mysterious Major von Schratt was carried out on a stretcher. The ambulance's side door slid open, and he was placed inside. The ambulance drove off with a muffled roar and turned out of the palace gates. Meanwhile, in the palace itself, the commotion continued right through until the morning. The lights continued to burn in the portrait galleries, and in the gilded halls, telephones rang, and the servants' faces began to adopt an expression that was little short of insolent, their eyes lighting up to show their amusement at the whole business. In a cramped little room on the ground floor of the palace, a man wearing the uniform of a colonel in the artillery regiment was standing by the telephone. Before lifting the receiver, he first carefully closed the door of the small, whitewashed communications room, a room that was totally unlike any other room in the palace. He asked the unsleeping operator at the exchange to connect him with telephone number 212. Obtaining the number, he said merci, and frowning with anxiety, asked in a soft, confidential tone, "Is that the headquarters of the Mortar Battalion?" Alas, alas, despite his best intentions, Colonel Malyshev was not able to sleep through until 6:30 the following morning. At 4 a.m., the little bird at Madame Anjou's started tweeting with extraordinary persistence, and the cadet on duty was forced to wake the colonel. The colonel awoke with astonishing speed, his brain getting into gear and operating at full stretch immediately, as if he hadn't been to sleep at all. The colonel, furthermore, wasn't angry with the cadet for interrupting his sleep. A little after 4, he was whisked away somewhere by the motorcycle, and by 5:00, when he returned to Madame Anjou's, he was frowning with anxiety, his expression exactly like that of the other colonel who had telephoned the mortar battalion from the palace communications room. At 7:00 the next morning, the very same extended file of men who had marched up the staircase towards the portrait of Tsar Alexander the previous evening stood by the battlefield of Borodino, illuminated in a rosy light. Huddled together from the pre-dawn cold, they were grumbling and muttering among themselves. Staff Captain Studzinski stood among the group of officers, a little apart from his men, and strange as it may sound, his eyes reflected exactly the same anxious expression as those of Colonel Malyshev 4 hours earlier. But anybody who might have seen both the colonel and the staff captain during that notorious night would definitely have been able to tell the difference between them. Studzinski's expression was one of anxiety about the future, whereas Malyshev's was one of certainty that he knew and understood exactly what the future held in store for them. Sticking out from the sleeve of Studzinski's greatcoat was a long list of the names of the men in his battalion. Having just taken the roll call, he was now certain that the unit was 20 men short. This would explain why the list was crumpled and bore the marks of his fingers all over it. The air was thick with smoke from the officer's cigarettes. At precisely 7:00, to the minute, Colonel Malyshev appeared before the assembled men, to be greeted as he had been during the evening before by a roar of welcome. And just like the previous evening, the colonel's silver saber was belted on his waist, except that this time, for some reason, its silver blade was not reflected 1,000 times by the light. A revolver in its holster hung on his right hip. The holster was unbuttoned, the result, no doubt, of Colonel Malyshev's uncharacteristically agitated state of mind. The colonel stepped out in front of his men, his gloved left hand placed on the hilt of his sword, and his uncovered right hand fingering his holster. He began to speak as follows.
"I would ask the officers and men of the mortar battalion to listen carefully to what I am about to say. During the course of the night, there have been marked and sudden changes affecting our position as a battalion, the wider position of the army, and I would say the overall political position of the Ukraine. As a result, I am announcing the disbandment of the battalion. I would consequently like each of you to remove all insignia from your uniforms, to take from the armaments store anything you're able to carry and that you might require, and then to disperse to your own homes, where you are to lie concealed, without giving yourselves away, and await a further summons from me. He fell silent for a moment, thereby underscoring even further the absolute and utter silence that filled the assembly hall. Even the lamps ceased their hissing. Everybody, officers and men, had their eyes fixed on one thing in the room, the colonel's clipped moustache. "Such a summons," he continued, "will follow as soon as there is any change in the position. But the chances of this happening, I have to say, are slim. I myself have no idea how everything will work out, but I think that the best that can be expected by each... by the best," the colonel said with sudden emphasis, "among you, is that you will be sent to join the forces on the Don. I therefore order the entire battalion, with the exception of those officers and cadets who have been guarding the building overnight, to disperse to their homes immediately."
"What's this? What's this?"
The entire body of men started whispering incredulously, and the forest of bayonets seemed to dip and wilt. Among many there was a look of utter bewilderment, but among some others, one of apparent jubilation. Staff Captain Studzinski, his eyes askance and his face a bluish pale colour, detached himself from the group of officers and took several steps towards Colonel Malyshev. Then he stopped and glanced round at the officers. But rather than look at the staff captain, Myshlaevsky kept his eyes firmly fixed on Colonel Malyshev's moustache, his expression indicating, as was his wont, that he wanted nothing better than to utter a whole string of obscenities. Karas just stood there blinking absurdly, his arms akimbo, while a separate group of young ensigns could be heard whispering one damning, alarming word: arrest.
"What's this? What are they saying?"
said somebody in a bass voice among the ranks of cadets.
"Arrest!
Treachery!"
As if taking inspiration from the light overhead, Studzinski suddenly looked up. Then he glanced quickly down at the butt of his holster and shouted, "Number one platoon!" The front rank broke up, and several grey figures detached themselves from it. A weirdly confused scene followed.
"Colonel,"
Studzinski said, his voice totally hoarse,
"you are under arrest."
"Arrest him!"
one of the ensigns suddenly shouted hysterically, stepping out towards the colonel.
"Wait, gentlemen,"
shouted Karas unhurriedly, sizing up the situation. Myshlaevsky leapt briskly out of the group of officers, seized the impulsive ensign by the sleeve of his greatcoat, and tugged him back.
"Let go of me, lieutenant,"
the ensign snarled, his mouth twisted with rage.
"Be quiet,"
the colonel shouted in an unusually assured voice. His mouth, it is true, was no less twisted than the ensign's, and his face had gone red and blotchy, but the expression in his eyes was more assured than was the case with any of the officers. And everybody stood still.
"Quiet,"
the colonel repeated.
"I order you to stay still and listen to me."
There was now absolute silence in the hall, and Myshlaevsky immediately looked alarmed. It was as if a light had suddenly been switched on in his head, and he was waiting for the colonel to say something that would prove to be of greater import and interest than anything he had said earlier.
"So then,"
the colonel said, his cheek twitching.
"Right. So then. I can see now exactly how fortunate I would have been if I had gone into battle with the unit that the Lord God has seen fit to provide me with. Really fortunate. But although it might be possible to forgive such behavior in the case of a student volunteer, or a young cadet, or perhaps even an ensign in extreme circumstances, this would be totally out of the question in your case, Staff Captain." As he said this, the colonel gave Studzinski a piercing look of quite exceptional hostility, his eyes flashing with genuine irritation. Once again, the room fell silent.
"Right then," the colonel continued. "I have never in my life participated in a rally until now, but it looks as if I shall have to do so. All right then, let's have a debate. Your attempt to arrest your commanding officer shows you to be good patriot, but it also reveals your, how can I put it, inexperience as officers. To put it briefly, I don't have the time to waste, and I can assure you," the colonel emphasized with menacing significance,
Neither have you. Now let me put a question to you. Who is it you wish to defend? Silence. I'm asking you, who is it you wish to defend? Mishlaevsky, burning with interest and curiosity, stepped forward from the rest, saluted, and said, It is our duty to defend the Hetman, Colonel. The Hetman, you say? Responded the Colonel. Excellent.
Battalion, attention!
He bawled suddenly with such force that the squadron instinctively shuddered.
Well, listen to this. Earlier this morning at about 4 o'clock, the Hetman fled the city, thereby shamefully abandoning us to our fate. Just ran away, like a total blackguard and coward. And an hour later, the Hetman was joined by our army commander, General of Cavalry Bielorukov, both of them heading for a German train that was waiting for them. And within a few hours at most, we will be witnesses to a catastrophe in which people such as yourselves, hoodwinked and embroiled in a venture not of your own choosing, will be slaughtered like cattle. Listen, Petliura is now drawing close to the city with an army of more than 100,000 men, and tomorrow... Wait, what am I talking about? Not tomorrow, but today. Here the colonel pointed out of the window, indicating where the sky over the city was already beginning to turn blue. Scattered and broken units of unfortunate officers and cadets, abandoned by staff officer bastards and those two scoundrels who deserve only to be hanged, will come up against Petliura's well-armed troops, who will outnumber them by 20 to 1.
Listen, my children!
Colonel Malyshev suddenly shouted, his voice breaking. Although he used the term, my children, to address the massed ranks standing in front of him with their bayonets fixed, the colonel himself was actually more of an age to be their older brother rather than their father.
Listen, as Staff Captain Studzinski will testify, I am an officer in the regular army who fought against the Germans throughout the war, and I am informing you that the responsibility for everything is mine and mine alone. It is on my conscience. I am sending you home. Do you understand? He shouted.
Yes, they all answered, their bayonets swaying. Then one of the cadets in the second rank broke into a fit of loud, convulsive weeping. Totally unexpectedly for the entire battalion, and no doubt for himself, Staff Captain Studzinski, in a gesture not fully befitting an officer, covered his eyes with his hands, allowing the list of names to fall on the floor, and burst into tears. Following the staff captain's example, many other cadets started sobbing, and the ranks of men began to break up. The voice of Radames Mishlaevsky rose above the disorderly hubbub of noise.
Cadet Pavlovsky, he barked at the bugler, sound the retreat!
May I have permission, Colonel, to set fire to the school building? Asked Mishlaevsky, looking directly at the colonel.
No, you may not, Malyshev replied courteously and calmly.
Colonel, sir, Mishlaevsky said emotionally, Petliura will get hold of the armament store, the weapons, and most importantly, he added, pointing at the door into the vestibule where the head of Tsar Alexander could be seen rising above the stairwell.
Yes, he will, confirmed the colonel politely.
But then why, Colonel?
Malyshev turned to Mishlaevsky with a thoughtful look on his face.
Lieutenant, he said, in 3 hours' time Petliura will be claiming the lives of hundreds of people, and my only regret will be that I will be unable to prevent their deaths by sacrificing my own life, as well as yours, far more valuable than mine, of course. I would ask you never to bring up the subject of the portraits, guns, and rifles again.
Colonel, Studzinski said, coming up to Malyshev. On my own behalf, and also on behalf of the officers whom I incited to behave in that disgraceful fashion just now, I would ask you to accept our apologies.
Accepted, answered the colonel courteously. By the time the morning mist lying over the city had begun to disperse, the blunt-snouted mortars standing on the school square had had their breech blocks removed, and the rifles and machine guns, now smashed into pieces, had been flung into the recesses of the attic. Whole piles of shells had been tossed into holes dug in the snow and into the hidey holes of the cellars, and the lights in the assembly hall and the corridors had been extinguished. On Mishlaevsky's orders, the white switchboard had been smashed by cadets wielding their bayonets. Outside, the sky was now totally blue, and under the blue sky, Mishlaevsky and Karas, the two who had been the last to leave the school, stopped for a moment on the square to talk.
"Did the commander warn Alexei?" Mishlaevsky asked Karas anxiously.
"Of course he did. You could see for yourself that he wasn't around," answered Karas.
"Will we be able to get to the Turbines this afternoon?"
"No, that won't be possible while it's still light. There's lots to do, including hiding things away. Let's go back to the apartment."
The sun was now shining in a blue sky. The mist was lifting and dispersing.